The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 6, Side 1. His father was an itinerant schoolteacher who would travel with his family, Koch, born in 1888, was the oldest of eight children, to remote communities on the Texas frontier and offer to hold a term of school, usually about 3 months, for $30 a month. Koch, named after Governor Richard Koch, a Confederate veteran who in 1873 wrested the government of Texas from the carpetbaggers and freed the state from the injustices of Reconstruction, got his only schooling in his father's classes. In his entire life he had 22 months of formal education. The Stevensons' poverty had forced Koch to go to work at the age of 10, building fences and digging irrigation ditches on nearby ranches for $1 a week. By the time he was 12, he was a cowhand on a ranch. At 14, while his father and mother homesteaded in Kimball County, deep in the hill country, the slender, dark-haired, serious-faced boy was herding steers in the fierce winds that whipped across the rugged mesas of the Continental Divide in New Mexico. By that time, he wanted a ranch of his own, wanted one desperately. Asked in later years what his early ambitions had been, he replied, "I never had any doubt. I wanted to be a rancher." His mother noticed that out of every pay he received, no matter how small it was, her son was careful to save something. When Koch was 16, his father opened a small general store in Junction, a little town in Kimball County wedged between high green hills on the banks of the Llano River. Stocking the store was a problem. It was as hard to bring manufactured goods into the hill country, cut off from the rest of Texas not only by its hills and its vast distances, but by the lack of roads and railroads, as it was for hill country farmers and ranchers to get their produce out of the hill country to market. A railroad had that very year pushed a line as far as Brady, some 70 miles away, but the Brady Junction Road was no more than a rough, rocky trail winding over the steep, jagged hills. In rainy spells it turned into a ribbon of mud. And rain made the seven swift hill country streams between Brady and Junction swell and race, and fording them could be dangerous even for a man on horseback. The thought of bringing a loaded wagon across all seven of them twice on each round trip was daunting. Men saw only danger in that trip. For hill country farmers and ranchers, one writer said, the task of bringing in supplies and getting the fruits of their labor to market was an arduous one, even when the roads were at their best. It was more than man and beast could stand when conditions were at their worst. But while Koch Stevenson saw the danger, he saw something else as well. Years later, he would tell a friend, I saw opportunity. With his savings, he bought a wagon and six horses. To induce merchants to use his freight line, he knew he would have to maintain a regular schedule. He announced that he would make a round trip every week, even though that meant logging more than 20 miles a day. Six-horse teams were generally driven from a seat on the wagon, but the old trail drivers with whom Koch had bunked in his ranch jobs had told the boy how such teams had been driven in the early days on the frontier. And that was how he drove his, sitting among them. By riding the lead horse, the one on the left in the wheel team closest to the wagon, he could spur him on and could reach the one beside him, too, with a kick. He used the whip on the other four. It was harder to sit a saddle all day than to sit on a wagon seat, but you could control the horses better and get the most out of them. The trip was as hard as men had foreseen. It would be many years before Koch Stevenson could bring himself to talk about the months during which, every day, you had to make 20 miles a day over those rocks and ruts with little chance that, should a wheel or an axle break or any of a thousand other possible mishaps occur on those seldom-traveled trails, someone would come along to help. When, decades later, he did talk about those months, men who knew the hill country and who could picture the difficulties he had surmounted would look at him with awe. He would unload his freight in Brady, fall asleep exhausted in the wagon yard, and be up before dawn the next morning to load up again and head out on the road back. When it rained out on the trail, he slept underneath the wagon. When it rained for several days, he would be wet through for several days. When the wagon mired in the mud, there was no one but him and the horses to get it out. "Once I got stuck so bad in a mud hole that I was there 11 days, he would recall. The rain kept falling. At night he was so wet and cold that he burrowed into the load of freight for warmth. But as a friend was to write, rare was the occasion when he did not maintain his schedule, and the confidence of his customers grew with each successfully completed trip. And opportunity had indeed been there. Carrying anything from a bolt of linen to a windmill, He earned enough to buy a second wagon, which he hitched behind the first, and he filled that with goods, too. He began to make money. $40 a month, he would later recall. But a freight line was not what he had always wanted, and by this time Coke Stevenson had decided there were better ways of getting what he wanted. He rode away for the textbooks, and each night on the trail, after he had cooked dinner and rubbed down the horses, one of his brothers was to recall how Coke treasured those six horses. They were all he had. He would build up the campfire and lie on his stomach in the circle of its light and teach himself bookkeeping. During those evenings, the teenage boy's only companions in the Dark Hills would be the horses and the books. A friend to whom years later Coke Stevenson talked about his experiences described them as evenings of loneliness. After 2 years of freighting, when he was 18, the opportunity for which he had been hoping appeared. Two brothers from England opened a bank in Junction. When he applied for a job, however, what he got instead was an insult. The president, Stevenson would recall, laughed at the idea of a freighter being a bookkeeper, but said that since no Negroes were in the town, he could use a janitor to sweep the floor and clean out the cuspidors. Men who knew Coke Stevenson in later years knew how quick a temper he had, but they also knew that he never showed it. As long as it was in a bank, the janitor's job might work up to something better than freighting, he felt. Although it paid only half the $40 a month he had been earning, he took it. Some months later, the bookkeeper became ill, and the president asked Coke if he could keep the books for a while. After he showed that he could, he was made bookkeeper, and then at the age of 20, cashier. But he was still not earning enough money to buy a ranch, and by this time he had found the ranch he wanted, the ranch of his dreams. One day, following the canyon of the South Llano River through the hills southwest of Junction, Stevenson had come to its low, broad, shimmering falls. Beyond them, framed against the canyon's limestone walls, a herd of deer grazed in a riverbank meadow until his horse was almost among them, and then leaped gracefully away, white tails flashing. As he watched, Stevenson was to recall, a flock of wild turkeys strutted out of one of the groves of spreading, sparkling-leaved live oaks that dotted the bank. In the river's clear rushing water, tall herons and cranes stood like statues. Splashing across a ford, he spurred his horse up the far bluff and came out onto broad, rolling upland pastures. Large swatches were covered with cedar, but cedar could be cleared away if a man was willing to put in the necessary effort. And while in most of the hill country the beauty of the landscape was a trap, concealing from would-be ranchers the aridity of the climate, this was one of the few stops on the vast Edwards Plateau in which water would not be a problem. 2 miles or so downriver was a 100-foot bluff, and from its face, from under a thick outcropping of rock, a sheet of water almost 100 yards wide cascaded to the river below. This was called the 700 Springs, because although subsequent exploration would reveal that the cascade came from a single spring, the rivulets pouring down the face of the rock gave the illusion of coming from many. Pushing through the cedar breaks in the pastures atop the bluff, Stevenson found hidden among them one stream after another, all clear and cold enough so that he knew them to be spring-fed, a source of abundant water. In later years, reporters traveling to that spot to interview Stevenson would marvel at its beauty. The river, one wrote, is as pretty a stream as you could conjure up in your dreams. 20-year-old Coke Stevenson determined in the instant that it would be the site of his house and the land around it his ranch. He rode away for more books. This time they were law books. He studied them at night, this young man with so little formal education, after the bank closed and the office of a Junction attorney, using the attorney's books as well. During the almost 5 years that he was studying, townspeople grew accustomed to seeing the light burn late in the attorney's office. Sometimes they said it burned all night. During the nights, too, he built a home in town for himself and his bride, Fay Wright, the ebullient, charming daughter of the local doctor. He built it with his own hands, working by the light of a lantern, using the lumber from 2 old frame houses that he tore down so that he would not have to spend the money he was saving to buy his ranch. In September 1913, Stevenson rode out of the hill country to San Antonio to take and pass the examination for his law degree. Early in 1914, he received his first substantial legal fee. With that and his savings, he bought his ranch, 520 acres at the falls of the South Llano, for $8 an acre. In that year, however, his life took a turning he hadn't planned. It was due to a number of qualities that he possessed. Some were physical. Coke Stevenson was tall, a little more than an inch over 6 feet, and strong, slender but wiry, with broad shoulders and big hands. He held himself very erect, and had a slow, careful, deliberate way of looking around him from the doorway before he stepped into a room. Like, in the words of a Texas historian, T.R. Fehrenbach, an old gunfighter squinting carefully down both sides of the street, evaluating the men, the weather, the lay of the land, before emerging into the sun. The famous, careful southwestern stare. He was very quiet. He had, a reporter says, the original poker face. Although his friends say he had a wonderful sense of humor, only his friends knew it. He seldom laughed out loud, but you'd suddenly look at him and see those big shoulders shaking and know Coke was enjoying the joke more than anyone. On serious matters, Coke kept his own counsel. He was slow to speak, another friend says. When he did speak, it was in the low, slow Texas cowboy drawl, and each word seemed carefully chosen. And when he spoke, other traits emerged, including one that even opponents define as sincerity. He quickly earned a reputation as an outstanding courtroom advocate. Coke would never say a word that he didn't believe, and that shone through, a fellow attorney says. When he spoke to a jury, the jury believed him. So did people outside the courtroom. Coke Stevenson didn't talk much, but when he talked, men listened. The tall young attorney in cowboy boots and ill-fitting suits was, without meaning to be, a leader of men. 1914, the year in which Stevenson bought his ranch, was a year in which Kimball County ranchers, always on the verge of financial disaster because of the thin, poor soil, the difficulty of getting goods in and out to market, and the recurring hill country droughts, were pushed to the very brink by a new menace, livestock thieves. It was suspected that the rustler's leader was the son of the country's most prominent and popular family. Capturing him red-handed might mean gunplay. Prosecuting him would mean antagonizing his family. Solving the rustling problem would be a dangerous yet delicate job. The county commissioners asked Stevenson to do it as the new county attorney. Stevenson had never considered holding public office, he was to recall. He accepted the appointment only on condition that he could resign it as soon as the crisis was over. Enlisting the help of Frank Hamer, already famous as perhaps the toughest of the Texas Rangers, Stevenson lay out with Hamer in the hills night after night waiting for the rustlers, captured them, and found that their leader was indeed the young man who had been suspected. The capture turned out to be the easy part of the job. At the time, Stevenson was to recall, he had little concept of public life. Receiving a crash course in the subject now, he didn't like it at all. Claiming he wasn't guilty, the young man's family said that the new county attorney had arrested him only to make a name for himself with a sensational case. Other Kimball residents felt that even if the young man was guilty, he should have been let off with a warning because of his family's contributions to the county. During the months the case dragged on, Stevenson's reaction to the criticism was dramatic. He refused to reply to it by a single word. And when the case ended, with the young man convicted and in jail, Stevenson, without a word, went back to the hills with Hamer to lay out again to trap the rest of the rustlers. Soon the news was out. Kimball was a good county for rustlers to avoid. But as Stevenson was leaving his first public office, he was given a second, for Kimball had another problem now, one even more serious than rustling. It was Stevenson's own fault that he was given this new position. During the previous year, 1917, the trail to Sonora, the only route from Junction to the west, had washed out, becoming, as one chronicler put it, a quagmire so hopeless that even a single horse had difficulty getting through. Trying to repair the trail, Junction's citizens had organized a work party along the lines of a barn raising, with every man bringing his own pick and shovel. But little progress was being made because the men were being given no direction, until, in his quiet, slow-speaking way, Coke Stevenson began giving it. As he made suggestions, the crowd of boisterous men quieted and listened to them and followed them. Stevenson had the men return to their ranches to get wagons and then had them fan out with the wagons, each carrying a team of men, across the hills to bring back the largest boulders they could find. The boulders were rolled into the mud, and when they sank from sight, more were brought until they rose above the surface. Then smaller rocks were added until the trail was restored. The ranchers thought the job was done, but Stevenson suggested that maybe it wasn't. As long as they'd put in so much work already, he said, maybe the trail should be smoothed out, made more like a real road. He had the men take their wagons to nearby streams, bring back gravel from the stream beds, and spread it and level it over the rocks. Now in January 1918, the road situation throughout Kimball County had become more critical. Much of the rest of Texas was being linked together by roads and rail, but the hill country was almost as isolated as ever. Laying tracks through hills was too expensive in a sparsely populated district, so railroads generally shunned the hill country. Most of America was entering the automobile age. The State Highway Department had been established in Texas, and construction of paved roads was underway in other sections of the state. But with a few exceptions, the most notable was the Fredericksburg-Austin Highway being built in that very year because of the heroic efforts of the representative from that area, Lyndon Johnson's father, Sam Ely Johnson. Hill country roads were as rudimentary as ever. Without rail connections to the rest of the state, trucks or wagons were the only means for the area's ranchers and farmers to get their produce to market, and because of the condition of the roads, their produce was often spoiled by the time it got there. With more and more roads being built elsewhere in the state, the competitive position of ranchers throughout the vast, isolated Texas hill country was steadily worsening, even before the terrible drought of 1916 and 1917. Nowhere was the situation more critical than in Kimball County. There were 200 motor vehicles in Kimball in 1918, but in all that huge county, larger than the state of Rhode Island, there was not a foot of paved road. Moreover, as a hill country chronicler wrote, no semblance of a system of roads connected them with the outside world. One evening in January, Junction's elder citizens met in the bank. This group of men had recognized that Junction in Kimball County had reached an important milestone, that it either must go forward or be lost in the shuffle of progress. Their only hope was to give the county some modern roads and to provide access to the markets of the state. They decided to pass a $150,000 bond issue to finance road construction, but they knew the work wouldn't get done unless someone took hold of the job and got it started on the right track. Coke Stevenson wasn't even at the meeting at the bank. He had had enough of public service. But if it wasn't for him, everyone knew, there would still be no road to Sonora. The young lawyer was sitting at home with his wife, reading in front of a fire, when, late in the evening, the phone rang, and he was summoned to the bank, where he was asked to accept the nomination for county judge, the county's chief administrative officer. At first he flatly refused, but so serious was the situation that finally, feeling he had no choice, he accepted on two conditions: that under no circumstances would he be asked to accept a second 2-year term, and that he would not have to campaign. His friends did the campaigning, and he won easily. During his 2 years as county judge, other qualities in Coke Stevenson became apparent. One was an unusual ability to persuade men to sacrifice for the common weal. Although $150,000 was more than the county's taxpayers could afford, it wasn't enough for the job, and Stevenson felt that none of it should be spent on right-of-way. The land, he said, should be donated, since its owners would benefit from the road. This proposal had been broached before and rejected. Now, at a number of public meetings, Stevenson spoke of how individuals should cooperate for the public good. The right-of-way was donated. By the end of the 2 years, Junction was linked by road with every other major town in the county, and it was being linked with the outside world. Rivalry had for years existed between Junction and Kerrville, a town in neighboring Kerr County, which lay between Kimball and San Antonio. But Stevenson persuaded Kerr's commissioners to co-sponsor a joint mass meeting of the two counties, at which Stevenson argued that Kerr should build a road that would meet Kimball's at the border and link the two county seats. When he had finished speaking in a slow, quiet way, Kerr agreed to do so. The agreement meant that Kimball would have a passable road most of the way to San Antonio. To build the roads, the man who had taught himself law taught himself engineering. Kimball's hills were laced with small streams and steep slopes. Building elevated bridges was prohibitively expensive, so roads would have to dip down to the streams, crossing them on roadbeds laid just above water level, and up again. Stevenson knew nothing about engineering and little about mathematics, but he cut miniature car wheels out of cardboard, figured the ratio with the Model T wheel, traveling at 25 miles per hour, the standard of the day, and tested the miniature wheels on various concave surfaces to determine the proper roll of the dips. It was, one writer was to say, testimony of the character of the road he built, that the Junction-Kerrville Road, the first piece of improved highway in all the immense distances between San Antonio and El Paso, was still in use more than 20 years later. By the end of his 2-year term, Coke Stevenson's fame had spread through the hill country, and a delegation called on him to ask him to run for Congress. Slow and thoughtful though he generally was, he answered this request quickly. "My public life," he was to recall in later years, "came about by accident. I did not deliberately set about entering public life. On the contrary, each time I held an office, It was for the purpose of getting a particular job completed. The jobs, rustler hunting and road building, were over, and he said so was his time in public life. In 1920, he returned to his law practice. During the next 8 years, the reputation of this self-taught lawyer continued to spread. From all across the vast Edwards Plateau, men traveled to Junction in the hope that Coke Stevenson would represent them in cases ranging from intricate land title suits to murder. He would never defend a man charged with livestock theft, cardinal crime of the Old West, and he would never accept a client, no matter how large the offered fee, in whose innocence he did not believe. Yet the docket for a single court term at Junction lists C.R. Stevenson as defense attorney in 27 out of 32 cases. His reputation spread further. Attorneys and judges from Houston and Dallas and San Antonio returned from hill country courts to tell their colleagues that in a little town in the middle of nowhere they had just watched what one of them called one of the greatest trial lawyers in the history of Texas. Sometimes he would try a case in the big city, and courtroom observers realized that that assessment was correct. Judge A.B. Martin of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said that Stevenson was the best all-round lawyer he had ever seen. Although he refused proffered partnerships and big city law firms as quickly as he had refused a congressional seat, he just didn't want to leave the hill country, Stevenson would say. He soon was reportedly being asked to try more lawsuits than any attorney in Texas. Before the end of his career, one writer reported, he had written landmarks in law books and the legal reports of the state, monuments of a wholly self-educated attorney that attorneys from great law schools studied. Together with friends, he founded many small businesses in Junction, a hardware store, a title abstract company, the first Ford automobile agency in the area. On Friday and Saturday nights, he ran the first motion picture show in Junction, operating the projector himself. Not that any of these businesses in the cash-poor hill country generated much cash profit. He was one of the organizers of a new bank, the First National Bank of Junction, and became its president. At the time he did so, the Junction State Bank, at which he had started as a janitor, asked him to continue as its attorney, even though he was now president of a competing bank. As one biographer put it, this stands as a sincere tribute to the respect in which Stevenson was held by his fellow townsmen. Coke Stevenson, it was said, was so honest that he could represent the two competing institutions at once. But Stevenson didn't spend most of his time in town. He spent it at the ranch, and whatever money he made, from the law practice, from the hardware store, from the bank, he put into that ranch. He purchased a second 500 acres, and then 1,000 more, and then another 1,000. By 1928, he owned more than 6,000 acres of the beautiful, spring-watered property he had come upon so long before. On the site below the falls that he had picked out for his home years earlier, he now built it with his own hands. Several years later, it burned down, and he built another house also with his own hands. This one had a wing solely for his books. His self-education had progressed from the practicalities of law to its philosophy and theory, and then to government, to history, and to biography. In the hill country, where books were so rare, Junction, like Johnson City, had no library. Most families owned only one book, the Bible. He had created a substantial library. He would read at night, but also in the mornings, before daylight. He rose very early every morning and put on a pot, a battered old graniteware pot, a very strong coffee. Then he would sit down with a book. Friends who stayed at the ranch remember sometimes getting up at 4 or 5 in the morning to go to the bathroom and seeing a lamp burning in the living room, and in its circle of light, Coke Stevenson reading, his huge, gnarled, powerful hands tenderly holding the book. "He treats his books like friends," one man would recall. "None of his books has a turned-down edge to mark the place. None has notes in the margin. If notes are needed, he makes them on a piece of paper and inserts them at the place." Fay designed this new house, a sprawling, spacious two-story structure with three great archways in front, and above them a long terrace. Coke built it, a room at a time as funds were available. It would take him 10 years to complete it. To implement his wife's drawings, he sent away for books on architecture and taught himself the rudiments of that profession. The house was somewhat Spanish and romantic in design, and it was built so that it couldn't be destroyed. Underneath the bright Indian rugs that covered them, the floors were of concrete. The ceiling and supporting beams were of concrete reinforced with steel. The walls, thick walls, were of concrete and native stone. A visitor said it was so solid that it was seemingly indestructible. Another compared it to a fortress. And it was, in a rough way, very impressive. Towering up to the 20-foot ceiling of the baronial living room was a huge, unbelievable stone fireplace. It was a stone Fay particularly liked that was found on a ridge some miles from the house. Coke lugged every stone home in a tow sack. Describing the house, the beautiful clear river near it, the shimmering falls, the herons standing on the river, the beavers splashing nearby, the herds of deer so tame they ate out of Coke's hand, a writer who was Coke's friend would call the Stevenson Ranch a dream ranch, the dream of a 10-year-old boy who always knew that he wanted to be a rancher. The ranch was a fortress, or at least a refuge from the world. Since Coke had refused to build even a rough low-water bridge across the South Llano, the only way of reaching it was by fording the river, which was not infrequently too high to be forded. He refused to have a telephone on the ranch. The closest town was Telegraph, a mile across the river, and that town consisted of one building, a store. The town had no telegraph. It had been given its name because telegraph poles had been cut from trees near there during the 1850s. "He loved that ranch," says his nephew, Robert Murphy. From time to time he had a hired man or two helping him, but mostly he worked it himself. He cleared it with his own hands, whole tracts of it. Coke Stevenson's fame as a lawyer was no greater than his fame as an axeman. He could swing a big double-bit axe with such accuracy that he could take a knot out of a log in a single stroke. He fenced the ranch himself. So hard was the hill country land, seldom more than a few inches of soil over limestone, that sometimes sinking a post, particularly a big corner post, required dynamite. If, Murphy says, you can imagine having to dynamite a post hole. But most of the time Stevenson used a cutting bar, a heavy steel bar with a sharp edge on it, raising it above his head and slamming it down over and over with all his strength. He loved the land, and he never let a day pass on the ranch that he didn't do something to improve the ranch, move a rock, sink a post, whatever, recalls Murphy, who would later live there for some years. He kept a bunch of old tools in his car, so if he saw something that needed doing, he could do it on the spot. That doing something on the ranch every day, that was one of his prideful things. No matter how busy he might be with legal or bank affairs, he let nothing keep him away for the crucial days in a ranchman's year. Goat and sheep shearing and cattle branding. His brand was CS on the left hip, nothing fancy. "I don't suppose there's been a calf on my ranch that I haven't branded myself," he was to say. He relaxed there, too. He and his wife played with their son, Coke Jr., and a visitor says, sometimes acted like they were still two kids themselves. Once, when the South Llano was high and fast, he bet Fay that he could drive his Model T 2 miles right down the middle of the river to the house, did it, and when he had won, jumped out, yelling like a boy. But he was to be lured into spending time away from that refuge. After 8 years, he was to find himself back on the road he had decided not to take, the political road. In part, he came back to that road because of his wife. Mother believed that Papa was a great, great man who should serve the people, Coke Stevenson Jr. says. She was a leader herself. Fay Wright Stevenson was later to be called the most beloved woman that official Texas has ever known. During the 1920s, she became active in the local branch of the Eastern Star, and then president of the Texas chapter of that international organization. The more time she spent in the Capitol, the more convinced she was that her husband could lead men on a stage much larger than the Kimball County Commissioner's Court. And she believed quite deeply that he should. Much as she loved the ranch, she did not believe Coke should spend his whole life there. She began urging him to run for office again. In larger part, perhaps, he returned to that road because of his reading. He had read the practicalities of the law and then the principles behind them. He buried himself in the history of the law, a friend was to say. Then he read history and turned more specifically to government and its theories, and the friend says he became lastingly inspired with the principles set forth in two documents, the constitutions of his country and his state. He read the two constitutions and took their words as literally as he read his Bible, and his reverence was no less deep. He adopted them to the bosom of his heart. The Constitution of Texas, drafted in 1876 by delegates, many of whom had worn the Confederate gray, several had been Confederate generals, representing a people who had seen, under a decade of carpetbagger rule, the injustices of which government was capable, was, as the Texas historian Fehrenbach puts it, an anti-government instrument. It not only bound the legislature within very tight limits, but said the legislature would henceforth no longer meet every year, but every other year, because, as one Texan said, the more the damn legislature meets, the more goddamned bills and taxes it passes. It was no more lenient with the executive branch. The powers of the governor were reduced to a point where he was one of the weakest in America. If future state governments prove burdensome or onerous, it ought not to be the fault of this convention, one of the delegates said. And indeed, the convention's handiwork made it, in Fehrenbach's words, almost impossible for government in Texas to be burdensome or onerous in the future. The spirit behind the Constitution was the spirit of farmers and ranchers. However much they believed in education, pensions, or government services, the taxes fell on them and their land. The Constitution was the embodiment of what Fehrenbach describes as a lasting philosophy that no legislature or governor was to be trusted. As a result, one analyst concludes, everything possible was done to limit the power of all branches of government. It was a document more fitted to be the constitution of the older agrarian South than of an emerging industrial state, but, as Fehrenbach says, none of these limitations was controversial. They were what the people wanted. Indeed, the people wanted them still. Every attempt to modify them had been voted down. The philosophy embodied in the Texas Constitution dovetailed with the philosophy of the man who studied it in the light of a pre-dawn fire in his ranch house by the South Llano. Its character was his. Thrift, frugality, parsimony, in fact. The Constitution enjoined these on government as he had enjoined them on himself. The saving that had begun at the age of 10, the diligently kept account book. In him, a friend was to write, there is an ingrained hatred of debt of all kinds. Limits on government, the devotion to individuality, to free enterprise, to individual freedom. He had lived his entire life by those principles. And the lessons of his life, almost the only lessons, in effect, that he had convinced him that the Constitution was correct. He had saved, stayed out of debt, foreseen his own destiny, known what he wanted, fought, with the aid of no one but his wife, to get it. And had he not attained his dream? His whole world added to that conviction. If the phrases of the Texas Constitution were phrases out of the 19th century, well, the hill country in which Coke Stevenson lived was really a 19th century world. The Constitution of the United States could, of course, in some ways be read as a document that restricted government in the name of individual freedom. Jefferson had been among those who so read it, and that was the way Coke Stevenson read it. He liked few novels. History was his romance. This man who had taught himself history, who had read in it so widely, had a love of history, in particular the history of his state, the proud heritage of Texas, almost religious in its depth. On his ranch, he had found an old log cabin. When he learned that it had been built by Jim Bowie not long before he rode off to his death at the Alamo, Stevenson built a shelter around the cabin to protect it from the elements so that it would stand as long as possible. He erected a flagpole in front of his ranch house, and on March 2nd, Texas Independence Day, and other state holidays, he would, with no one around to watch but his wife and son, solemnly raise, in those lonely empty hills, the Lone Star flag. And he believed that the very essence of that heritage, independence, freedom, was embodied in those two constitutions. Now in the 1920s, he was coming to believe that the government of Texas was doing violence to that heritage and those principles. The inefficiency of the state government, in particular the antics of a legislature whose lack of responsibility must, he felt, lead to higher taxes, troubled hill country ranchers. No one in Austin seemed interested in economy, they said. Of course not, it wasn't their own money they were spending. The particular issue that angered him was a proposal to float a bond issue, huge in terms of the time, to improve the state's highway system. Stevenson recognized the urgent need for highways, but a bond issue meant debt. And in the plans being floated for highways, the needs of the hill country were being neglected along with those of West Texas, and he thought he knew the reason why. These ranching areas were underpopulated and did not have enough weight in state politics. Stevenson began to tell friends, in his quiet, slow way, the ranch people need representation. Although he had no intention of providing that representation himself, in 1928, 8 years after he had left public office, the legislative seat from his district fell vacant, and once again a delegation of fellow ranchers asked Coke Stevenson to represent them in government. Once again he refused. But the only candidate who was nominated, a politician from Junction's rival town of Kerrville, was, in Stevenson's view, a free spender, of whose political philosophy I did not approve. He tried to persuade a number of conservative ranchers to run. When they all refused, at the last minute Stevenson agreed to make the race, and won. Almost from the day he arrived in Austin in 1929, he was, an observer wrote, a marked man, marked by the same qualities that had marked him in the Hill Country. Austin was still the city of the three B's, beefsteak, bourbon, and blondes, that it had been when Sam Ely Johnson had been a legislator there 10 years before. Congress Avenue was still lined with bars and whorehouses at which lobbyists maintained charge accounts for cooperative legislators. Beneath the great dome of the Capitol, the legislature met in an atmosphere so raucous that it sometimes seemed almost indistinguishable from the nightly scene at the bar in the Driscoll Hotel. Coke was an unusual figure against this backdrop. He was more silent than ever. He had taken to smoking a pipe, and he seemed never to be without it. When he was asked a question, he would light the pipe, staring down into its bowl as he did so, or puff deeply on it, thinking before he answered. Years of clearing timber and hauling stones and pounding post holes into that hard hill country rock had broadened his body so that it matched his great shoulders, and he was as erect as ever and still had the same slow, careful southwestern stare, and the same way, so graceful for a big man, of walking lightly on the balls of his feet. He liked drinking with the boys, who were legislators now rather than ranchers, and he was in his quiet way soon as popular at the Driscoll Bar as he had been in Junction. When a party was being organized for a hunting trip, he was usually one of the first ones asked. And men who went hunting with him learned that behind that stolid exterior was a sense of humor. Some of Coke's gags would, in fact, become staples of Austin lore. During a hunting trip with several fellow legislators and a lobbyist, for example, a rancher, an old friend, called Stevenson aside and told him that in one of the back pastures where the men were to hunt was an aged horse, an old family pet, so infirm that it should be destroyed. The rancher asked Stevenson to do it for him. Stevenson agreed. As the hunter's car was passing the horse, he asked the driver to stop and got out. "I think I'll just kill that old horse," he said, and taking aim, shot it in the head. His companions, unaware of the rancher's request, stared in amazement. "Why did you shoot that horse?" the lobbyist finally asked. "I just always wondered what it would feel like to shoot a horse," Stevenson drawled. Pausing, he stared hard at the lobbyist. "Now I'm wondering what it would feel like to shoot a man." But although in Austin Stevenson was with the crowd at the Driscoll Bar, he was in a way not of it. There was a reserve, a dignity, about this tall, broad-shouldered, silent man, with that watchful stare, that set him apart from the crowd. And, of course, he was set apart from many legislators by something else, too. "You just instinctively knew that Coke Stevenson was not someone you could approach with any kind of an offer at all," one lobbyist recalls today. "I mean, did you ever see him? If you ever had, if you ever saw that stone stare when he got angry, you would know what I mean. No one would have dared to offer Coke Stevenson a dime." And although he was a regular at the Driscoll Bar, he regularly left it early to return to the house where he lived quietly with Fay. Coke could never bear to be separated for any length of time from his wife. "Coke's off reading again," his friends would say. And of course they did not know the extent of that reading. Who else in Austin was awake at 5 a.m.? Much of his reading during these years was not of books, but of legislation, proposed and actual, of state budgets, of memoranda submitted to legislators by state agencies that went generally unread. His reading at the ranch had given him a rare command of governmental philosophies, principles, and theories. Now he was gaining as well an understanding of the minutiae and intricacies of state government so detailed that it would become legendary in Austin. "I think Coke really hated politics," an Austin politician says. "Truly hated it, the deals, the maneuverings. It just went completely against the grain of the man. But he loved government, loved it, and knew it as few men did. If you started talking about wheeling and dealing, trading votes, whatever, what you got from Coke was that stone stare. Sometimes it wasn't that he was angry, it was just that he was bored. But if you were talking about what government should do and why we should do it, then you had his interest." He was soon deeply respected in that political city, not as a politician, but as a public official who felt that a legislator's responsibilities extended beyond the district that had elected him. Not only did he quickly secure the passage of legislation needed by ranch people, he was instrumental in the passage of laws with broader, statewide significance. The man who so hated waste saw waste everywhere in the government of Texas and set out to stop it. Learning that there was no auditing whatsoever of the expenditures of state agencies, he wrote, introduced, and pushed to passage a bill establishing the Office of State Auditor. To end the state's antiquated bookkeeping practices, which effectively prevented not only taxpayers but public officials from monitoring state expenditures, he pushed for and won enactment of laws making the state's bookkeeping more efficient. One of his biographers was to say that, as he saw it, the issue was glaringly simple. From the time he was a youth, he had written down in his ledgers every personal expenditure he made. He knew where his money went. The taxpayers were entitled to know where their money went. Asked the purpose of these laws, he said, to get the people out of debt. He didn't want their money wasted on roads either, as much as he understood the need for a modern highway network. Governor Ross S. Sterling was proposing a constitutional amendment authorizing the huge highway bond issue, more than $300 million, to be financed by a gasoline tax. Waste and corruption in highway building were already a joke. The solution, Stevenson said, was not to give the highway department more money and spend still more on debt service for the bond issue. He proposed an alternative plan. Use the gasoline tax revenue not for the service on new debt, but to retire the old debt, the bonds already issued by individual counties to build roads within their own borders. This would ease local tax burdens. It would get the people out of debt. Use the balance of the gasoline tax revenues to build new highways, but on a pay-as-you-go basis. He had calculated how many miles of highways could thus be built annually, Stevenson said, and it was enough to meet the state's highway needs, particularly since none of the new revenues would be spent on new debt service. The highway lobby, oil and gas companies, road-building contractors, massed against him. At times it seemed that Coke Stevenson and his philosophy were all that was standing against legislative approval of the constitutional amendment. But he stood. Passage required the vote of 2/3 or 100 of the 150 House members. Gradually, the number of affirmative votes climbed as the pressure was skillfully applied, a historian has written. The number of affirmative votes finally reached 99, but number 100 never was obtained. There was, moreover, a new huge proposal for improvements in the state's prisons. Stevenson had known bookkeeping and highway building. He didn't know prisons, so he set out to teach himself about them. He visited all the state prisons in Texas, visited them and slept in cells with the convicts. He visited prisons in the Northeast, and the reforms he then proposed not only improved Texas prisons, but did so at a fraction of the cost of the governor's proposals. Stevenson had pushed his auditing, bookkeeping, highway, and prison legislation in quiet talks with his fellow legislators. He received little public attention, but his fellow legislators had learned about him. His rare speeches on the floor of the House commanded unusual attention. In the towering red granite capitol in Austin, as in the little Kimball County courthouse, when Coke Stevenson spoke, men listened. He spent not a minute more in Austin than he had to. As soon as the House adjourned each week, he and Fay would be on the road back to the place they loved. It was still with no bridge as cut off from the world as ever. And there was still no telephone. Stevenson had refused to have one installed. If someone urgently needed to get in touch with Stevenson, he would call the party line in the rickety, somewhat lopsided little general store in the town of Telegraph, and the owner would ride over and notify Coke, who would ride back and talk. In 1933, there was an urgent call. His fellow legislators had caucused and had decided he would be their next speaker. Accepting, he made clear that he would still not put in a phone. "The darn thing would be ringing all the time," he said. "If it's important, they'll get in touch with me." When he was speaker, he still snatched every moment possible to be on the ranch. As adjournment neared each week, Fay would have their car waiting outside the Capitol. Banging down his gavel to end the session, Coke would stride out of the House chamber and within minutes would be on the road, speeding along the 166 miles back to the world he and Fay had created. He was a rather unusual speaker. No matter how loud the shouting became on the floor of the House, he never raised his voice. At first he was criticized for what Austin political observers called loose herding, refusing to assert tight control over the 150 representatives. He didn't mind the term. What was the alternative? The tactics that would later be called arm-twisting? He wouldn't engage in that, he told intimates. There should, he believed, be time for debate, for reasoned consideration of issues. That, after all, was one of the purposes of a legislative body. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.